Section 4, South Carolina in the Building of a New Nation. As you read, look for how harsh conditions after the Revolutionary War led to disorder in the nation and state. Concessions that improved life in the upcountry. The adoption of a new United States Constitution. The rise of political parties based on different interpretations of the U.S. Constitution. The invention that promoted a cotton culture in the upcountry. Terms: Commerce Compromise, Three-Fifths Compromise, Great Compromise, Federalist, Anti-Federalist, Constitution of 1790, Federalist Party, Democratic-Republican Party, Cotton Gin, Compromise of 1808, Suffrage. The war finally concluded when the British evacuated Charlestown in December of 1782, and the final peace treaty was signed at Paris on September 3, 1783. Henry Lawrence was one of the negotiators, along with Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Jay. The treaty recognized our independence and gave all the land east of the Mississippi River to the new nation, except for Canada to the north, Florida to the south, and the city of New Orleans. Conditions within the state at war's end. South Carolina suffered greatly during the years from 1759 to 1783. Two Cherokee Wars, the Regulator Controversy, the rebellion against the British Empire, and civil war within the state contributed to the misery. Thousands of Loyalists left the state, taking their wealth, slaves, and talents with them. Many slaves had been taken away by the British or had escaped, causing a loss of manpower and talent needed to rebuild the economy. Bitterness lingered after the Loyalist-Patriot conflict. The loss of men in battle left thousands of widows and many farms without manpower. The state's economy was in chaos. Guerrilla warfare had wrecked the countryside. Conditions in the towns were no better. Grain mills, churches, and stores had been burned. Most of Camden lay in ruins, and Georgetown had been partially destroyed. In the post-war years, bad economic and social conditions continued. Independence meant the state no longer had automatic access to the great market the empire had provided for Carolina products. Indigo production ceased now that the British bounty was gone. Rice planters had bad crop yields in 1783, 84, and 85, exporting less than half the amount of rice they were exporting 10 years earlier. The upcountry farmers had not found a staple crop to provide a steady income. Many people were in debt, and some defied debt collectors and tax collectors. Debtors closed down some courthouses to prevent their land being taken through mortgage foreclosures. One mob of debtors ransacked and burned a courthouse. To deal with disorder in the capital, the General Assembly incorporated Charlestown as the city of Charleston in 1783, giving its citizens more self-government. Some of the disorder was taking on a class and sectional tone, as the poorer upcountry population was increasingly hostile to lowcountry domination of the government. The legislature created counties within county courts in 1785 to give more access to legal transactions and justice. Another concession to the upcountry landowners was a fairer land tax that was based on the value of the land. From Charleston's point of view, probably the greatest concession to the upcountry was the reluctant agreement in 1786 to move the capital to the center of the state. A site was selected where the Broad and Saluda Rivers unite to form the Congaree. The capital was to be a planned city with broad streets, many named for Revolutionary War heroes, laid out in a neat grid pattern. The city, called Columbia, would be the first city in the United States named for Christopher Columbus. conditions in the nation. The national economic picture in the 1780s was no better than that in South Carolina, and the national government had little power to deal with it. The Articles of Confederation had created a very weak central government with no president or national court system. It had no power to negotiate trade deals with other nations or to regulate commerce among the states. It could not even levy taxes. It could only request that the states pay their fair share. Most states only paid a portion of what was asked. The weakness of the government did not cause the economic failures and social disorder, but it prevented the Congress in Philadelphia from solving the problems. Trouble was brewing in several states. Many people felt the national government must be strengthened if independence was to be preserved and order restored. During the Revolution, the power of government seemed the great enemy. Now, a more powerful government seemed a necessity. The New Constitution. In 1786, the Congress approved calling a convention, which met in Philadelphia in 1787 and drew up a new Constitution. South Carolina's representatives to the Constitutional Convention were four accomplished men who distinguished themselves in the convention's debates: John Rutledge, Pierce Butler, Charles Pinckney, and his cousin, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. They were lawyers and planters, representing Charleston's interests, not those of the whole state. They argued very forcefully for an aristocratic republic run by an educated and wealthy elite. They wanted state control of all commerce, including the slave trade, but had to accept the Commerce Compromise. This allowed states to control commerce within their boundaries, but let the national government control trade among the states and with foreign nations. The compromise also allowed federal tariffs on imports, but not on exports. And the slave trade was protected for 20 years. The delegation wanted slaves counted for the purposes of representation in the Congress, but had to settle for the famous 3/5 compromise, which allowed 3/5 of the slave population to count for representation purposes. Another major compromise in the convention also had to do with representation. The states with large populations wanted representation in Congress to be based on population. The smaller states wanted representation from each state to be equal. The great compromise was to create a bicameral, two-house Congress. The number of members allotted to each state in the House of Representatives would be proportional to its population. The Senate would give each state an equal number of senators, two each. To become law, a bill would have to pass both houses and be approved by the president. The product of the convention was ratified by the states and became the United States Constitution. The new Constitution gave more power to the central government. The most important new power was the ability to levy and collect taxes. The new government had an executive, the president, and a federal court system. But the Constitution limited the power of the new government by giving it authority to do only certain things. The first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, adopted in 1791, limited the national government's control over citizens and states. Government's power was also limited by a system of checks and balances among its executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Finally, the concept of federalism forced the national government to share power with the states. The Constitution intentionally established tension between the federal and state governments, which was supposed to keep both in line. But the balance of power had definitely shifted to the national government. The white people of South Carolina were divided on the new Constitution. Much of the division was sectional. Lowcountry leaders who wanted strong government to maintain order and protect property were called Federalist. They were the political elite of the Lowcountry, including the four signers of the Constitution. The majority of citizens in the upcountry opposed the new Constitution. they feared a stronger government might interfere with their individual liberties, and they opposed the aristocratic republic favored by the Low Country leadership. These more democratic Carolinians, the Anti-Federalists, were led by Thomas Sumter, Judge Adamus Burke, and Rawlins Lowndes. Despite these objections, a special convention easily ratified the Constitution. The Low Country had far more delegates than the Up Country, even though the Up Country had far more voting citizens. The South Carolina Constitution of 1790. After the new United States Constitution went into effect in 1789, South Carolina wrote a new state constitution. The Constitution of 1790 retained most power in the House of Representatives and with wealthy property owners. To be elected to the House, a man had to own at least 500 acres of land and 10 slaves, or the equivalent. A senator had to own twice as much wealth, a governor 10 times as much. The General Assembly, not the people, elected the governor, other state executive office holders, judges, and most local officials. The voters were not trusted with much responsibility. Politics under the new constitutions. President George Washington made a famous journey through South Carolina and other southern states in 1791, promoting national unity. He feared that citizens would become divided into political parties. That fear was justified. Two political parties began to develop quickly around the personalities of his cabinet members, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton advocated an active and strong government that would stimulate commerce and industry, build roads, improve harbors, and establish a national bank to help regulate the economy. Jefferson and his followers would leave most of these activities to the various states. The party of Hamilton was called the Federalist Party. The party of Jefferson was called the Democratic-Republican Party, or simply the Republican Party. The parties split over their different interpretations of the Constitution. Hamilton adopted a broad interpretation, meaning the government could do anything that the Constitution did not specifically forbid. Jefferson believed in a strict interpretation, meaning the government could only do those things the Constitution specifically allowed. In South Carolina, most of those who wanted the new Constitution became Federalist, with the major exceptions of Charles Pinckney and Pierce Butler, who soon became Democratic Republicans. Anti-Federalists were attracted to the party of Jefferson. The Federalists dominated in the early 1790s, and their representatives tended to support Hamilton's ideas. He wanted the federal government to assume, take over, the debts of the 13 states, which South Carolina approved because its debt was greatest of all the states. Hamilton hoped assumption of states' debts would make the states and wealthy investors more loyal to the new government. Other southern states tended to disapprove, but agreed to accept assumption in return for the national capital being moved south to the Virginia-Maryland border. Hamilton also succeeded in getting the United States Bank established, owned partly by the government and partly by private individuals. The Congress also approved tariffs on certain imports to raise funds for the government. Hamilton's party tended to favor business and commercial interest. Jefferson's party tended to favor agricultural interest and small farmers. But that is a simplification. Neither party acted purely or solely in the interest of one group or ideal. One major example is the Louisiana Purchase. Jefferson believed the government could only do what the Constitution said it could. The Constitution did not say the president could buy territory for the nation. However, when France offered to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States in 1803, he jumped at the chance. In one swift act, he doubled the size of the country. The parties differed greatly in their views on foreign policy. The new nation was confronted with a dangerous crisis between Britain and France that lasted from 1789 to 1815. In 1789, the French people rebelled against the king in the Great French Revolution. After a moderate stage of limited monarchy, the revolution became more radical. The revolutionaries executed the king and set up a republic. War broke out between France and most of Europe as the republic tried to spread the ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Many Jeffersonians in America saw this as a European extension of the American Revolution. To Federalists, it seemed like a chaotic nightmare. In foreign policy, the Democratic Republicans favored the French. The Federalists wanted closer relations with the British. But George Washington insisted on keeping the United States neutral in the European struggles. America finally went to war against Britain in 1812, with South Carolina's congressman leading the way, but that is a later story. While the Federalists dominated South Carolina in the early 1790s, the Democratic Republicans gradually increased their strength and became the dominant party in both the state and nation. By 1804, when Charles Cotesworth Pinckney was the Federalist candidate for president, Jefferson beat him even in his own state. Jefferson was popular partially because of the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, which opened up so much new territory in the West for expansion. The rise of the more democratic of the two parties had important consequences for South Carolina, especially for the upcountry. The beginning of the cotton culture. The Constitution of 1790 continued to give more representatives in the General Assembly to the Low Country. Leaders in the upcountry, such as John Kershaw of Camden, Wade Hampton of Richland County, and Robert Goodloe Harper of 96, founded the Representative Reform Association in 1794 and began strong pressure for more representation for the upcountry. Lowcountry leaders did not have to give in to them until the upcountry developed more economic clout, power, influence. That clout was about to appear. The upcountry farmers needed a staple crop. Rice and long fiber, or Sea Island cotton, had brought wealth to the lowcountry, but they would only grow on the coast and sea islands. Short fiber cotton would grow well almost anywhere, but it was difficult to remove the seed. That was about to change. In 1793, Eli Whitney produced the cotton gin, a simple engine or gin that could rapidly remove fiber from seed, and the cotton kingdom began in the South. Soon, Wade Hampton and other planters began to raise short fiber cotton in the Midlands and Piedmont using large numbers of slaves. Anti-slavery attitudes that had developed during the Revolution, especially among Quakers, Methodists, and Presbyterians, were discarded as cotton production and slave labor expanded. Cotton planters in the upcountry used their wealth and influence to gain concessions from the coastal elite. In 1801, the General Assembly agreed to establish South Carolina College in Columbia as a tax-supported institution. Fairer representation in government for the other sections of the state was finally allowed in the Compromise of 1808. The interesting formula was this. Each electoral district got one representative for each 1/62 of the population, and one for each 1/62 of the wealth of the state. The Lowcountry, with its wealth, still had some advantage, but the upcountry, after 1808, had a majority in both houses of the General Assembly. The Compromise of 1808 shows that the upcountry cotton planters and the Lowcountry planters and merchants now had similar interests. Both were totally dedicated to slavery. That Compromise of 1808 gave stability and order to the government in the years prior to the Civil War in the 1860s. The property-owning class felt so confident of its control of the state's affairs that it allowed a constitutional amendment in 1810 that extended suffrage, the right to vote, to all white males, even if they did not own property. Requiring no property ownership for voting was an important step toward democracy. South Carolina was the first state in the Union to extend the vote to all white adult males. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, 3/5 compromise, Democratic-Republican Party, cotton gin. 2. What change took place to Charlestown in 1783? 3. Why did Lowcountry and Upcountry citizens differ in their approval of the new U.S. Constitution? The following is a summary of Chapter 7. The dominance of the British over the French in North America was established as a result of the French and Indian War in 1763. Although the British won, the war proved to be very costly to their treasury. The result of that was the beginning of strict regulations over the British colonies in North America. The colonies enjoyed being part of the great British Empire, but colonists believed that they were being unfairly treated because of what they called taxation without representation. Attempts to satisfy the colonies were not nearly enough in the eyes of the colonial leaders. Britain's indifference toward colonial discontent eventually broke into fighting between the colonies and Great Britain beginning in 1775. At first, the colonies were fighting for representation in the British Parliament, but when it became apparent that would not happen, the colonies decided that independence from Britain was their goal. The fight for independence was long and brutal. In South Carolina, colonists were not only fighting the British soldiers, they were fighting among themselves. The Patriots favored independence. They fought against the Loyalists who supported the King's armies and British rule. The War for Independence would last from 1776 until the Treaty of Paris was signed in 1783. With the end of the American Revolution came the need for a government for the new states. After a less than successful government under the Articles of Confederation and much discussion and compromise, the U.S. Constitution was accepted as the government for the United States of America.